Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's Fourth Branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. Welcome to the inaugural episode of RTP's new Tech Roundup podcast series. In these shows, you'll hear from the foremost experts at the intersection of emerging technology, regulation, and the law as they address the ever-changing world of innovative digital technologies.
Hello, my name is Will Reinhardt, and I'm pleased to welcome you to the inaugural episode of the Tech Roundup for the Regulatory Transparency Project's Fourth Branch podcast. In this series, we're going to be talking with tech policy experts and trying to get started a lively discussion about some emerging tech issues that are going on in the world today. Today, we've got two experts to talk about the issue of deepfakes, which I know is becoming kind of a hot topic. So first up, we've got Bobby Chesney, who is the James Baker Chair at the University of Texas Law School, and is a co-founder of the website Lawfare, as well as the co-author with Daniel Citrone of the article Deepfakes, a looming challenge for privacy, democracy, and national security. I've actually got that paper here with me right now. So Bobby, thanks for joining us. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Of course. And we're going to be, we're recording on a Friday here today, which is kind of nice. It's one of the last things I have to do during the day. And I just harvested a whole bunch of jalapeno peppers. So I'm going to be making a whole bunch of tacos this weekend, which I'm actually really excited about. But in the studio, we've got Matthew Feeney. He is the director of Cato Institute's Project on Emerging Technologies, where he works on a number of issues concerning the intersection of new technologies and civil liberties. Matthew, thanks for coming on and thanks for chatting. How are you doing today?
So far, so good.
So first off, really, I want to start with you, Matthew. If you could really just kind of open up this discussion, really, what are deepfakes? You know, where did the term come from? And really, how have they progressed in sophistication over the last couple of years?
Yeah, it's a relatively new term. It's a combination of deep learning and the word fake. And it's a term that's applied to content where using AI and video, you can make it appear as if someone is a totally different person in a variety of contexts. I know a lot of people are concerned about what it means at a time where someone could just make it look as if the president said something when he didn't. And I urge anyone who hasn't seen any of these videos to look them up. They're easily accessible on YouTube and other platforms. I would say, I don't know if I'm really known as being too gullible a person, but the sophistication of these is rather disturbing. They look very realistic, and I can understand why many people, if they were none the wiser, would be fooled by them.
Yeah, and Bobby, I was wondering if you could kind of follow up on there. You've written, obviously, this, I think, a really amazing piece, which I'm sure we're going to be linking to it within the show notes. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, like, you know, this development and really the GAN generated stuff and some of the stuff that's happening within the deepfakes that you talked about within your paper.
Well, thanks for the kind words about the paper. I appreciate it. The thing I often hear when I talk about this at events is, fraud's nothing new, fake's nothing new. You can have, you know, all sorts of existing technologies to manipulate video and audio. What's so special and different now? A lot of people will come back and say, I saw, you know, Grand Moff Tarkin reappear despite the death of Peter Cushing, looking just like him because the Star Wars movie was able to recreate him. And
that's
it's true
super
that
nerdy reference too.
You like that? Yeah. Well, that is fine. That's the last one I'm going to give. It's true that industrial light and magic can do stuff like this, that Hollywood can do it. What's interesting about the technological development that we're talking about here is that it produces fakery that's in when it's a true deep fake, really generated using a generative adversarial network approach using machine learning. It's going to be, once it's had a chance to cook for a while, it's going to produce things that are above the threshold of your eyes and ears ability to detect it as modified. And that's eventually going to get to be the case even for people who've really trained at subtle clues. It's certainly the case for just run-of-the-mill, you know, consumers of content online. But that alone's not the real key part. The key part is that the technology for doing it it, by its nature, it's going to be able to disseminate and propagate pretty widely. There's going to be a lot of, and is a lot of, commercial investment in developing business models for offering this as a service. Now, obviously, if you hire a company, a legitimate company, to do this sort of thing, they're not going to turn around and create some sort of weaponized deepfake to, you know, commit some obvious fraud on somebody. But the dark web will provide a version of that, this sort of harm through deepfakes as a service, much as you can already go in the dark web and obtain the ability to DDoS somebody or to do various other things. So it's the fact that the technology isn't the sort of thing that's resource scarce. There is some key knowledge, to be sure, but it's only a matter of time, nearer rather than longer in the future, when the ability to access kind of capacity is really going to be widely distributed to a broad range of actors. It won't be the sole province of industrial light and magic or, you know, an intelligence agency.
Yeah, so could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, what do you foresee are some of these, you know, positive but also kind of scary applications of the deep fake technology, at least in the near future?
Well, I appreciate you start with the positive, because of course it's tempting to, you know, treat it as if it's only harmful, but, you know, it's like any other technology. It's got its potentially good uses, potentially bad uses. Some of the goods, just to knock out a few possibilities, a lot of interesting and really cool educational applications, lots of obvious artistic applications. The utility for satire is obvious. It's also part of the problem. And then some other really nifty and subtle uses. For example, there's an effort underway to use this to restore, in a certain sense, your original voice for people who've lost the ability to speak, you know, for example, due to ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. You know, famously, for those who are acquainted with the type of problems that arise for people suffering from that terrible disease, you lose your voice. There's still this ability to cue a computer and machine vocalization of what you put in is, you know, a familiar thing. But imagine being able to have your own voice or something very close to it expressing those words. So lots of good there. The negatives in the article, Danielle and I provide a typology of harms at the individual, organizational, and societal, indeed global levels. To hit some highlights, this is going to be a really useful technology for bespoke sabotage of your business rivals, your employment rivals, your romantic rivals. And in those cases where some rival who's unscrupulous has decided to attempt to put you in a horrible light, it doesn't necessarily have to be broadly distributed. It doesn't have to be something that goes up on a social media platform that depicts you appearing to go on a racist rant, for example. Instead, it could be slipped in a very subtle fashion just to the one decision-making person, whether it's the person you're wanting to cultivate a relationship with, the person you want to hire you, the boss you want to give you a promotion. You can do it that way, and there's a decent chance you'll never know what happened to you. You just know that you didn't get the promotion or you weren't given the second date. More broadly, everyone can appreciate the use cases involving elections, impacts on elections. That's sort of an obvious and self-explanatory one. There are plenty of other systematic or broader harmful uses. A careful and cleverly deployed deepfake could spark civil unrest. If there's a community where, say, law enforcement and local citizens are at odds with one another, this could be used to precipitate an incident. It could be used for stock market manipulation if you want to do something that will enable or cause a temporary dip in the price of a stock. You could cause a diplomatic incident. You could cause local populations in an occupation setting or any place where there are soldiers in a tense situation where there's some amount of insurgency or violence against them. You can precipitate that sort of thing as well. In short, everything that has always been possible to be done with fraudulent representations of what people have said or done, all those same harms are now going to be performable at a higher level of sophistication and persuasion than was the case previously, except for those with the most resources and technical capacities. It's going to democratize access to the ability to cause those sorts of harms.
So I hate to, you know, focus a lot, you know, and ask you all the questions, Bobby, but, you know, one of the things that I thought was really interesting about your paper is this kind of distinction between distribution, kind of narrow distribution, and distribution at scale, between the kind of narrow targeted applications that potentially could be disruptive, as well as this kind of larger distribution, you know, in the kind of context that you were talking about, with that could potentially harm national security. I mean, just to start off this conversation, what do you see as kind of the reactions to this? I mean, could you see, you know, detection? Could you see some actors being able to say, okay, you know, this truly is a deep fake, and we kind of know it by, you know, X, Y, and Z characteristics? And what do you think is the possibility of at least being able to detect deep fakes in the near future as these things kind of proliferate?
Yeah, the framing, you made me think about Homer Simpson. There's an episode where Homer has, I'm probably going to get mangled the quote, but he basically says, ah, beer, the cause of and cure to all of life's problems. So is if technology is giving us this nice little gift, can technology also be the solution to it so that we don't need to have conversations about legal, you know, changes to the legal framework, et cetera. To a certain extent, sure, and also to a certain extent, who knows what the future holds. There is a ton of ongoing academic interest across the world, not just in American universities, not just in creating deepfakes, but in detecting them as well. And of course, when we talk about the underlying method of generative adversarial networks, the GAN method, you know, the whole essence of that method is pitting a creation algorithm against a detection algorithm. Leads some people to think that, therefore, the better we get at this creating them, the better we get at detecting them. It's important to recognize it's not in a level playing field in the following respect. It is true that if you own the GAN, if you've got the dueling algorithms that created a particular deepfake, then you have in your hands a technology for detection that is really well tailored to the particular creation you're looking at. But someone else's machine learning approach is going to produce some different form of deepfakes that your detection algorithm is by no means necessarily any good for. I mean, it might or might not be. There's a lot of varying scientific opinion out there about this right now, but certainly my impression after spending, you know, a couple of years in the weeds on this is that the majority view is that the creation side has the advantage for now. There is a lot of commercial research going on that is focusing not just on post hoc detection, but if that's going to prove to be a moving goalpost, as it were, what about authentication on the front end or digital provenance? And there are companies like TruePic that are in the business of point of capture authentication that creates a reliable, auditable, verifiable hallmarks that are difficult, you can't really say impossible, but difficult to alter. Those are extremely promising, and in context where people have the resources and the motivation to use those authentication mechanisms, certainly that helps a ton. The real issue there is the question of whether and to what extent we can ever expect there to be widespread voluntary uptake of these technologies, such that all the endless array of sensors, you know, it's not just our phones, it's every IoT camera and recording device, everything with a microphone or a camera on it, at what point do they all or pretty much all have this sort of digital providence aspect to them? Because if the answer is, well, there's a lot of that, but it's by no means ubiquitous, well, then anyone who's creating a false content or synthetic content that doesn't have the hallmarks, as long as they're not presenting it as having been taken or captured via a device that you'd expect to have that, as long as they can say, like, well, this is video captured by, you know, the surveillance camera that's cheap and you wouldn't expect it to have that anyways, you have an out as to why it's still credible. So, yes, there's a lot of tech development driving towards these defensive-minded solutions. We're a long way from having any reason to think that they're going to become so ubiquitous and reliable that they defeat the ability of fraudsters to make hay with this type of technology.
So Matthew, I know you've been following this issue very closely as well, and you know, I was probably very similar to you. You know, I was watching the hearing that happened in the House not too long ago. I guess it was almost 2 months ago now. So could you just kind of lay out what has been suggested on the regulatory front? What is it that the conversation is trending towards? What is it that the policy conversation and people who are in policy really need to know about this, about, you know, potential changes and potential regulatory reactions to this, to these developments?
Well, certainly up on the Hill, you've had a few suggestions. One, Senator Sasse, for example, introduced a bill that would institute effectively an alt-right ban on this kind of technology. But as best as I can tell, that hasn't gone anywhere.
Yeah.
You have also on the other side of the aisle, you have Senator Warner a while ago issued a white paper that laid out a bunch of proposals tackling a number of different issues. And one was a suggested reform to what's called Section 230 in order to tackle this deepfake issue. Section 230 has been in the news a lot recently, thanks to discussions about alleged social media bias.
Yeah.
It's Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act that provides civil liability for the vast majority of content that users upload or post to sites like Facebook and Twitter, yeah, and so forth. And Warner seems open to some sort of 230 reform that would apply to deepfakes, such that if you could prove that you'd had a dignitary tort, right, if you'd been the victim of a deepfake harassment, and his idea is that eventually you would be able to actually hold certain sites liable for hosting that content or for not taking it down quick enough. So those are the kind of proposals that people are throwing out there. Of course, as Warner himself even noted, though, in the paper, it might be difficult to distinguish outright harassment from satire or parody, which is protected speech, and what one would argue very valuable.
Yeah, so I mean, to kind of continue with that, you know, you'd mentioned obviously this Warner discussion. Is there something currently you think that the public is really missing from this discussion, the legal discussion? I mean, it seems that when we talk about deep fakes, they're always wrapped up in this conversation of Section 230, which, you know, mm-hmm, as you kind of noted, has been. It seems as somebody who's been in tech policy now, I mean, I've been in nearly 10 years. It's something that we always talked about, you know, pretty extensively, but now everyone seems to really, really care about Section 230, mm-hmm, and really how that integrates with these conversations. Is there something else you think that the public really should be understanding about this, or should know about this kind of conversation that really isn't being talked about with regards to deepfakes?
I think this probably applies to a lot of the issues we discuss, which is it's complicated.
Yeah.
That this is a broad kind of technology that has interesting, useful, but also rather dangerous applications and implications. I think when we are worried about obvious, you know, no kind of content that people would applaud, right, which is revenge porn and that kind of content, I think we need to be careful that in attempts to tackle that, we don't stifle or hamper legitimate speech, which is political parody and satire. And in preparing for this, I was reminded of that there was a Supreme Court case in the 80s, Hustler versus Falwell, which is a fascinating case, but the holding there was rather interesting, namely that parodies of public figures which could not reasonably be believed as real are protected against civil liability. So we might have everyone, I think, wants a world, or at least liberals, for example, classical liberals and liberals alike, would want a world where you could have deepfake content that shows the president of a country engaging in a sexual act with a relative or other politician, right? It's totally protected as a cartoon, or if you described and deepfake would certainly be an interesting way to do that. But we are, of course, also worried about the potential application when it comes to harassment.
Yeah, and I think this is actually something that's interesting within your paper as well, Bobby, is that you actually had mentioned that the porn industry, which is always seems to be kind of on the forefront of these questions about content creation of various sorts. One of the things that I've noticed is that within the industry, there's been kind of this rally around not using these sets of technologies. That there's kind of a I don't want to say a gentleman's agreement, but there's a sort of agreement within the industry itself not to effectively use these technologies going forward. I mean, what are some of the other things that could potentially be done here, and what is it that you think that isn't necessarily being discussed that really should be discussed in a way to deal with these problems?
Well, there are a couple of things I want to mention, but first I want to come back to this issue of legislative intervention and the bill that Senator Sasson introduced. I would rise to its defense a little bit in response to the way it was described. I don't think it's fair to describe it as an attempt to ban the technology. I think that what it very clearly required as a necessary condition for federal criminal liability was that the communication at issue, it's not just that it was made using however we define the boundaries of deep fake, but that it be already illegal under state, the tortious or criminal under existing state or federal law, which of course raises a separate question, like, well, then what's the point? And the idea was, in effect, to create a clear base, at least this is my interpretation of it, to create a clear basis for federal law enforcement with its perhaps superior access to investigative technologies that might be relevant here, and in general to bring the federal law enforcement possibility into the picture in these types of cases, which may or may not be a good idea. That presents federalism of criminal law type issues, just as the ongoing current debates about whether we need a new federal domestic terrorism statute does. But it was clear they were trying not to simply ban the technology, because I agree that it's preposterous to talk about just banning the idea, to say, well, we shall have no, or it shall be a crime to use generative adversarial networks and neural network modeling approaches. That's a terrible idea. No one should do that. But turning away from legal responses, which, I think everyone agrees, the attempts to further prohibit these exceedingly harmful uses, even if they're not cumulative, they're not going to necessarily, there's certainly no one thinks going to solve the problem. A lot of people say, well, what about education? What about podcasts like this? And what about making sure that everyone gets better, improved skills for critical assessment of the information they're taking on? And of course, to say that is to sort of roll our eyes and realize we have a much bigger problem already than deep fakes with respect to people not bringing adequate critical reasoning skills to bear, and the ability to understand the possible biases of the sources you're consulting, et cetera. We have a huge problem with that as a society. We're not going to snap our fingers and fix it for deep fakes if we don't know how to fix it more generally. But also, imagine that's not right and I'm being too pessimistic. Say we actually come up with this really great training video and everybody watches it, and wow, we all come to realize this technology exists and we can be tricked, and therefore be on your guard anytime somebody tries to show you evidence that your eyes and ears want to credit. Danielle and I write in the paper, and this is probably the thing, aside from just the general alarm bell aspects of the paper, in terms of the substantive contributions, the thing that's gotten the most uptake, and I think probably rightly so, the observation that this is a huge benefit to those who would lie about what they really did say, what they really did do, that's captured on tape, as it were. We call it the liar's dividend. If the public becomes sensitized to the idea of deepfakes, it creates mental space to more persuasively deny the truth when you're caught on tape. So if you will, to borrow a phrase, fake news, well, you just say deep fake news, and you brush off the evidence of something that's captured on film. So great risk there. Separately, we observed that if this does begin over the next, say, 10 years to become an increasingly serious problem, at some point, if there's enough public anxiety about it, you'll start to see a market reaction where products and services might emerge to help people self-defend against the prospect of getting tanked in this way or sabotaged in this way. And there'll be certain categories like politicians or the key figures in publicly traded companies who will have especially strong interest in adopting ubiquitous life logging practices that are going to be very detrimental to the privacy of, well, themselves by definition, but also those who come into contact with them and who are around them. And it's tempting to say in response to that, as many people have said to me, that, look, not many people are really going to go in for that at the end of the day. There could be settings, especially corporate settings and governmental settings, where it's not the person's choice. And here we might analogize a bit, or we might compare at least, to police departments uptaking body cameras, not because all the police departments are super excited about it, but because it became necessary and to some extent forced upon them in some settings. It is possible to imagine insurance pressures and other pressures leading to adoption of this sort of practice as a matter of course. And of course, this will happen at the same time that wearable sensors become ever more popular. And, you know, Google Glasses had their moment in the sun. They went away. They're going to come back. Google Contacts or whatever the next equivalent is, along with your watch and everything else, will be sensing and able to record everything around you anyways, may well be doing it anyways. I'm afraid this will be another stick in the fire that encourages this sort of ubiquitous and omnipresent surveillance.
Well, I guess honestly that about wraps it up. To be honest, I think we were really kind of delving into Black Mirror territory with some of these discussions, because I mean that is literally, I think it's what, the third or second episode or something along those lines, where every single individual effectively has some sort of camera on them, and it's in their eye, and so they can, you know, go back and actually reproduce all these events in their life, which is to me a bit scary. Needless to say, thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate you for listening today to this inaugural Tech Roundup episode. We're looking forward to bringing you even more episodes in the future. So be sure to subscribe wherever you find your podcasts, and please follow the Regulatory Transparency Project on Twitter. You can find that at FedSocRTP. That's FedSocRTP. Until next time, my name is Will Reinhardt, and have a good one.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.